Today on Pilot's Discretion, our guest is author and retired airline captain Steve Green. He explains the fundamental truth about any accident, the right way to use an autopilot, and what he learned from surviving an airplane crash. Pilot's Discretion starts right now. Welcome, pilots. I'm John Zimmerman of Sporties, and thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion. If you like the show, please follow us in your favorite podcast app and leave a review to help others find the show. Also, remember you can catch up on every previous episode by visiting sporties.com/podcast. And you can always contact us, podcast@sporties.com. Today, I'm really excited to have Steve Green on the show. He has been a pilot for over 50 years, logging nearly 20,000 hours during a long career that began in Convairs and ended in Boeings. But in addition to that long and interesting airline career, he's also one of the most thoughtful writers on aviation safety, risk, and the role of a pilot in the modern cockpit. He has served on numerous industry committees. He has written a number of interesting articles for Airfax, which we'll link to in the show notes. And he has just released a new book, Pilot Competency and Capability: Responsibilities, Strategy, and Command. It is highly technical, but it's also one of the most thought-provoking aviation books I've ever read. Steve, welcome to Pilot's Discretion.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
So you write at the beginning of your book, quote, "The most fundamental truth about any accident is simply that you will never, ever, not in a million years, ever see the one coming that gets you," end quote. Why is that truth so important?
I think it's important because we think of accidents in a storytelling form. We use a narrative mode of thought, and all stories are what we might call linear. They basically orbit around cause and effect. So we have something happen, we have a resolution, we have everything's back to normal. The accident that actually happens to you isn't a story until it's all over with. So you're never really going to see it coming. Now, most people think that's fairly obvious when they initially think about it, because of course you're not going to see it coming. If you did, you wouldn't let it get you. But when they think about it for a little while, then they think, well, wait a minute, if I'm not going to see it coming, how am I going to prevent it? And that gets pretty scary. I mean, because you suddenly feel like you're adrift, you're blind, you really don't know what's going to happen. And all of the ideas about preventing accidents generally that we work with are built around the stories that we know. So those are good. Those form a body of experience that we might call mistakes we don't want to make. But the one that happens to you is going to be new. It's going to be different. It's never happened to you before. And it has a tendency to be all over with before you ever even saw it coming. So we need to think differently about how accidents happen. And we certainly want to identify narratives that we can see coming, that we've studied, and we can say, well, I'm on the track to follow that narrative and I don't want that to happen. But we also have to keep in mind that as good as we get at that, the actual accident that you experience is going to be one you never thought of, never saw coming. It's just bang, it's over with and too late.
Yeah, you're right. That's one of those simple truths that has profound implications once you really come to grips with it. And you write later in the book, I thought this might be the line of the book: airmanship may be less about managing systems and quite a bit more about managing uncertainty, which really is, when you think about it, the job of pilots, at least once you've got 40 hours and you know how to fly the airplane. And one of the ways you talk about managing that uncertainty is this concept of margins. That's a concept I've heard for years. I worked with Dick Collins for about a decade, and he always talked about margins. I think it's a great concept, but tell me what you mean by that. What does margins mean, and how does that protect you from the accident you won't see coming?
Well, we operate in a world that's constructed of margins, particularly the professional piloting world. We have margins everywhere. We have landing distance margins. We have fuel reserve margins. We've got gross to net climb performance margins, 1.3 G stall margins at cruise altitude, et cetera. We're surrounded by margins. The job, to my mind, the number one job of the professional pilot is protect those margins. The margins are what give you room to manage the uncertainty. So it's unacceptable in my mind to encroach on those margins. Those margins really have to be protected very, very strongly. The way we do that, in my thinking, is through the idea of strategy. We need an overall goal. What is it we're trying to do here? Probably one of the easiest examples of strategy that we are all familiar with is a stabilized approach. That's a strategy. You can fly a stabilized approach with flaps, without flaps, one engine, two engines. You can do it in all kinds of different configurations and situations, but the overall strategy is we want the approach to be stable. So we're going to do what it takes to keep the approach stable. That's going to involve protecting margins with ref speeds and bank angles and so on and so forth. The way you build a strategy is through the idea of prudence. And this is a really interesting concept, but there are three fundamental components that go into prudence. First one is taking counsel, which we're all sort of familiar with, studying the weather, listening to older, wiser pilots, consulting with whatever information sources you think are appropriate. You're going to take all the counsel you can. The second step is you're going to judge of what you have learned in that counsel. And the third step is you're going to execute command. You're going to make some decisions. Buried within that are a number of elements. Three of the most important ones are foresight. You got to be way ahead thinking about what's the final goal. The next one is circumspection, which is circling back around and looking at the strategy and modifying the strategy. It was a good plan when we left. It's not such a good plan now. We need to update it. And the third one is caution. And caution is really interesting because it invokes understanding the uncertainty that you're dealing with and being aware that you probably aren't going to see all of the specifics that would give you the certainty you want. So the prudence equation leads you to develop a strategy and update the strategy all along the lines of protecting all of the margins that you have. And that may include fattening some of those margins up. Case study is in the airline, flying the 737, my minimum fuel over the final approach fix was 5,000 pounds. Now, the company would typically dispatch me in a manner that would put me over the final approach fix with 3,500 pounds. A lot of times the dispatcher had already added fuel. Sometimes I would add some more. The point about the 5,000 pounds was it takes me 1,500 pounds at a minimum to execute one go-around. 2,000 pounds qualifies as an emergency procedure in the quick reference handbook. So we're not going to get ourselves in a situation where we're, you know, encroaching on what could actually be an emergency just because we had to go around. We want to have enough margin over the final approach fix to accommodate all the uncertainty that we may encounter. Now, as we come up the Caribbean, we may encounter some interesting weather. We may end up deviating. We may have to go a fair distance around some lines of storms. All the while we're doing that, we have to be updating the strategy with the idea that we still have to get to a final approach fix, whether it's the destination or somewhere else. We have to get to a final approach fix with 5,000 pounds of fuel. So how are we going to do that? And that's how we make decisions as we execute command and so on and so forth.
That's a fascinating approach that, you know, I think one of the themes of this podcast, if there is one, is understanding the pilot and command mindset and what that's really all about and how to apply that in practice. And I love this concept of strategy, but I wonder how we teach it, if we teach it. Is that something you learn on the job from an experienced captain in the airline world? Is that something you can learn during primary training? If I'm interested in going beyond just running checklists and following numbers, and I want to have this higher level approach of having a strategy, how should we as an aviation industry teach that?
I think that's a good question. I don't think we do teach it. I think we acquire it, but I think that many of us don't really know what it is that we're doing. We're doing it, but we can't really put words to it necessarily. I don't think anybody starts out and says we need to talk about strategy. I mean, that's we tend to be much narrower, and that really gets into the discussion of risk and understanding the differences, for example, between specific risk and probabilistic risk. The specific risk approach deals very strongly with narrative. We know that one story is an engine failure. That's a very specific risk. We can talk about that probabilistically, but it's still built around a complete narrative. What we don't really talk about is all of the uncertainties and unknowns, and because we don't know what they are, so it's really hard to talk about them. You know, we tend to gravitate towards these known sequences of events, and we may build a strategy. The example, for example, that I've used when I use the 5,000 pounds over the final approach fix, I immediately think of the two times that I had to go around because we put the wheels down and we didn't get three green lights. So we're going to have to go around. Well, both times it's a bulb. Just replace the bulb and everything's fine. But I might have to go around for who knows what reason. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. I just have to make sure I've got that margin protected so that I can absorb whatever it is that happens. So the idea behind a strategy is this big picture, this overall goal. What it is I really want to make sure I has that happens. And it applies in various stages of the flight. I mean, there's all kinds of what we might consider to be smaller strategies that are involved, but like a stabilized approach being one. But we need to think in terms of what's the big picture and how are we going to get that to happen?
Part of this, I wonder if it's related to something you've written about recently, the concept of systems knowledge and an understanding of the airplane you're flying, just beyond the SOPs and what the basic instruments are telling you. So tell me where you land on the debate, the discussion about how much systems knowledge do pilots need. I mean, there's, you know, some people say, hey, I don't need to learn how to overhaul the engine. I just need to know how to operate it. So can we cut through the 47 pages of engine theory? And there's probably some truth to that. There, you can go too far. But my guess is you would argue we don't go far enough.
We don't. And that's been a really hot topic lately. It's a challenging topic. I think we need to go back and start with this wonderful quote that is in the book. It came out of a 1939 Civil Aviation Authority report. They were looking for ways to identify ideal pilot candidates, and they wanted the extroverted kind of person. And what they said in there was that ideal candidate exhibits, and I'll quote, such features in their daily lives as simultaneous interests in a number of business enterprises, frequent entertainment, lack of interest in abstract thought, hearty dispositions, and carefree attitudes. And this, I just really made me laugh when I first read it, because it described probably 90% of the guys that I've flown with in my career. The key phrase in there, though, is lack of interest in abstract thought. And what happens when we get into these deep systems discussions is they get abstract, and people are just not, you know, they just are not predisposed to have that kind of interest. Some guys are. I mean, there's always a guy that is really, really into it, but most people generally don't want to get that deep. When we get to the protecting the margins idea, there are basically five sets of margins. There's aerodynamic margins, which are the top priority. I mean, if the airplane's not flying, the rest of them don't matter. So we've got angle of attack, bank angle, G loading, those sorts of things. We have altitude margins, you know, MEAs and MOCAs. We have performance margins, which are the ones we're fairly familiar with. We got to figure out if, you know, what the takeoff distance is and this sort of thing. We have airworthiness margins, which, you know, on a complicated airplane is if you have a system fail, how airworthy is the airplane? Is it still, you know, airworthy? And the one that I think is the most interesting that we may not think about very often is this idea of a margin of residual attention. So you've got to have enough residual attention to be able to keep up with what's going on. And you can get overwhelmed very quickly. I mean, that's not hard to have happen at all in some complicated situations. The trick with systems knowledge is the more you understand the systems, the more residual attention you're going to have, because you're not going to be surprised by what it's doing. You're not going to be confused by what it's doing. You're going to have a really good handle on how this thing works and what's happening when it does whatever it is that it does. The more of that you can develop, the more residual attention you're going to have in the actual situation. And that margin of residual attention is just phenomenally important. Now, there are obviously some things in the system that you probably don't need to know. I mean, I think we can all agree that we're not going to take the thing apart and overhaul it. But we have also gotten, because of this notion about abstract thinking and our desire to avoid it, and our description of in-depth systems training is more abstract than necessary, we've kind of veered away from that. And it really does get back to this, you know, push a button and you get a banana pellet kind of approach. And I think we've seen plenty of examples in the last few years of how that doesn't work at all.
Yeah, that obviously tees up the automation debate, which we could spend the whole episode talking about. And in some ways is tired, the, you know, children of the magenta line routine. But I thought you had a great approach to this in an Airfax article. You talked about two situational awarenesses. You know, pilots talk about having situational awareness, but you break it down into two different ones, the airplane and the automation, which to me ties right into that idea of having attention and being in the loop. What do you mean by those two different situational awarenesses, and how would I put that into practice?
Well, the original one, you know, which I describe as, you know, where are we? Where's the ground? Where are we going? And at what angle of attack, is pretty traditional. It's the one I use in my little Piper Pacer all the time. But we have a new one with all of the automation that we've added. And this actually, for me, has been fascinating, because up until a few years ago, I had no idea that a Cessna 172 had a flight level change mode. I mean, that's just beyond my comprehension. But it does. And all of these things have kind of, you know, come down from the higher level, you know, airline type systems. So now we have a new situational awareness, which is, where does the autoflight system think we are, which is not necessarily where we actually are. Where does it think we want to go? How does it plan to get us there? All of which are different from the original situational awareness, potentially different. I mean, hopefully not, but potentially they are. And then the last one, piece of that is, where are we within one of the flight envelopes that this automation is designed to protect us from departing? So are we going to run into one of these thresholds where it starts to try to constrain us? And unless you really understand the automation, you're not going to know all that. And so the important thing here is you really have to know your automation cold. You have to know how it works, what it's trying to do, what its little foibles are, when it's going to try to constrain you from doing something, which may or may not be appropriate or what you want. So, you know, the lead-in I used in that article was, you know, the conversation that I had with the autopilot, which occasionally probably distracted the first officer, but, you know, it would basically be like, what are you doing? You know, where are you going? What are you doing with this? You know, did I tell you to do that? No, that's not what I want to be doing right now. You know, there's one of my favorites is, you make a descent with a flight management computer and you get an intermediate level off. And so you drop out of VNAV into a speed mode. And if you're not paying attention, you're not going to notice that the speed that it decides to use at that point is way below what you want to be at. And all of a sudden you realize, why are we doing 210 knots? You know, well, that's what this thing popped up with. That's not what I want. So I've got to, you know, and after you've had enough of that experience, or hopefully been appropriately trained, you're going to see that coming. You got to say, okay, as soon as it levels off, I got to check the speed. And if I don't like what I'm seeing, I'm either going to dial it up or do something, but I'm going to get us back to where I want us to be. So you really have to have a relationship with the automation. It's a real good tool, lots of advantages, but you can't, you know, you have to go back to this idea that I wrote about that Saint-Exupéry published when he wrote Rinse, Sand, and Stars, and it was a great idea that in our enthusiasm for rapid mechanical conquests, we've overlooked some things. He said, we have perhaps driven men into the service of the machine instead of building machinery for the service of man. And that's kind of the drift that I see us going with automation. It's more like you're the pilot, you just follow the automation and it'll do everything you need that it needs to do. And that's really an unhealthy approach. You're the pilot, you're flying the airplane, you're using the automation to assist in flying the airplane, but when it decides to do something that you don't think is right, you need to work that out. Somehow you got to resolve that problem. One of the other problems you get into with automation, which is sort of a tangent to that, and this really intrigues me because I don't really have a good solution for it, and that is that when you're using the automation, you have to watch the automation, you have to monitor it. And we see all kinds of discussions by the safety board and inadequate monitoring and so on and so forth. So we understand that we really have to monitor this thing, but then we have to decide if it's doing what we want it to do or not. And that takes time. That takes residual attention. Once we've decided it's not doing what we want it to do, we need to make a change, which takes some more time. That's fine if you have the time. If you don't have the time, that may not be so appropriate. There were many cases where, you know, I would disconnect an auto throttle on an approach because it was pretty squirrely, and I'm not really sure I want to take the time to see whether this auto throttle is doing what I need it to do. I can manually operate the throttles quite effectively. I know where I want the power. I know what I need to do. And it makes things easier in my mind. And this may not be true for people. I mean, I started flying with my first 5,000 hours. I had no autopilot. So this is pretty instinctive. But it just makes it easier to move the automation out of the way if I don't know that I have the time to monitor it effectively. You get into other situations, for example, an auto landing, where you're going to use the automation and you're going to monitor it and you're not going to disconnect it because that's just not, you don't do that, you know. But you also have a very constrained set of circumstances that you're using that in, and you've done a thorough briefing and you know exactly what you're looking for. And this second you see something not right, you're just going to go around. I mean, that's a high gain environment where our monitoring is really, really on a high refresh rate, if you will. But it's a very controlled situation with all kinds of constraints that are built into it. When we're operating in environments that are less constrained, less controlled, that's where we really have to kind of be cautious about how we're working with the automation and how we're monitoring it. And remember, you can't monitor it if you don't understand it.
Yeah, I think to me that ties it all together. This concept of two situational awarenesses, where are we in the airplane and where do we want to be going? That's that high level on having a strategy. And then there's the compare that to what does the automation think we're doing and where are their differences there? And you can't really answer that question without the system's knowledge. So it really kind of ties all those together. Steve, let's take a quick break and we'll be back with some more questions.
Earn all your pilot ratings and keep your flying skills sharp with Sporty's Pilot Training Plus. This all-inclusive membership unlocks Sporty's complete library of award-winning video courses, so you can learn anywhere you have your phone, tablet, or laptop. For one annual fee, you get access to over $1,500 in courses, a smart investment in your flying career. Plus, enjoy free shipping every day of the year at Sporties.com and apply for one of our three annual flight training scholarships. Learn more at sporties.com/pilot training. Now, back to Pilot's Discretion.
We are back with Steve Green, who wrote a moving article on Airfax a few years ago about his experience surviving an airplane crash many years ago. Steve, as you wrote, quote, "On a single radiant New England summer day, my career, my life, took an abrupt, brutal, and wrenchingly painful turn. On June 25, 1978, I crashed a Grumman Yankee trainer in the mountains just north of Lake Winnipesaukee, New Hampshire." End quote. You were rescued, but only after 2 days in the forest and some serious injuries. Obviously a huge event in anyone's life, but how did that change your career, do you think, as a pilot? Do you approach things differently with that experience?
It's interesting. It was, it'll be 45 years this weekend since that happened. And it obviously was the beginning of almost everything. The book is actually dedicated to my friend who did not survive. That was where I, as I recovered, I began the sort of journey of trying to work out what's going on here, what happened. I don't know for sure what happened. It appeared that we had encountered a downdraft. We were pretty low over the ridges north of Winnipesaukee. The downdraft made no sense. It was a perfect summer evening. There was no wind. There was no wind aloft. But we did not appear that we were going to make it over the next ridge. Added power. That didn't seem to make any difference. So I started to turn away from the ridge. My guess is that I probably got into an accelerated stall. I don't know that, but that would make some sense. But the upshot is, I have no idea what really happened. The investigation doesn't know what happened. They, as is not uncommon with these types of accident reports, they tend to backfill the narrative with all kinds of interesting things that may or may not be relevant to what actually happened, because we just don't have the data. There's no DFDR, there's no recorders. My account from the hospital, which is largely how they constructed the report, was my impression, but I don't know. I really have no idea what happened. So I began this process of trying to work out what happened and understand the nature of these things. And that continued through pretty extensive involvement in aircraft accident investigation. I worked on a lot of accidents as an ALPA representative, working with the NTSB and so forth. So it definitely made an enormous change. I don't know where I would be if that hadn't happened, but that's the nature of those things.
You mentioned the accident investigation. I know you've done a lot of work on some icing research over the years, including the landmark Roselawn, Indiana accident. On the topic of icing, a subject to me still filled with conjecture and old wives' tales more than science for a lot of pilots. What's the most surprising thing you've learned during all that research on icing that you think maybe most pilots don't understand or even know about?
I think, well, there's two things that have been really salient. One of them is icing is a really neat, compact example of what we call nonlinearity. And if we go back to what we were saying earlier about storytelling, accident reports tending to be a narrative that follows a linear path, problem with icing is it is a nonlinear type of phenomena. Different ice shapes affect different airfoils different ways, and the ice shape develops in different ways depending on angle of attack, liquid water content, a whole bunch of variables. And the actual outcome of that ice shape is really, really hard to predict. So we have a nonlinear phenomena. It's constrained by certain things. The ice shape's only going to get so big before the airflow starts to constrain it and that sort of thing. But it's still, it's nonlinear. It's predictable in principle, but not in specificity. And if you think about that, we can apply that to a lot of other weather situations, weather being one of the prime examples of protecting margins. A thunderstorm is predictable in principle, but not specificity. You know, we've got all kinds of neat diagrams of thunderstorms, but the one you're looking at right now is hard to know exactly what it's going to do. how it's going to develop, how the outflow is going to interact with adjacent storms, and so forth. So the nonlinearity piece is a really big part of icing. The other piece, which I think is really interesting, is what Diane Vaughan in her book on the Challenger referred to as the normalization of deviance, which is this tendency to build a body of experience and misinterpret what that experience means. And in the Challenger case, they had a body of experience with different O-ring failures, and they thought they had resolved them all. And so they were building this idea that they understood the O-ring failures, and they had actually misinterpreted a lot of what was going on. This is exactly what happens when we talk about icing and we have guys talking about how much ice their airplane will carry. And basically what's going on is they have successfully navigated a variety of ice shapes and nothing has happened. And what they're not aware of is that if you look at the lift curve and the NACA 23012 airfoil that is really a common airfoil in turboprop airplanes, if you go up the 23012's lift curve with or without an ice shape, the iced lift curve almost perfectly overlays the clean lift curve until you get to the cliff. And then it breaks off very radically much earlier than the clean lift curve. So as long as you're operating underneath that cliff, you're not going to notice anything. But you have no idea how close to that cliff you are. So when you tell me how much ice your airplane will carry, I know right away you don't understand the lift curve and you really don't know where you were. But what happens is we build this body of experience, so that allows us to normalize deviance from a clean wing. So we think, and this is actually encoded in the way the FAA has approached this for years. And even when we look at the icing severity index, you know, trace, light, moderate, basically what that says is a little bit's okay, a little more is not too bad, a little more than that might be getting bad, any more than that's probably a problem. It's a very linear way of thinking about the ice. And then we turn around and we have DC-10, hard wing DC-10s, the Dash 10 series, have a series of takeoff accidents, and we do scientific research and we find out that just a few thousandths of an inch of frost on the wing is enough to make the difference. So how is that going to apply to trace, light, moderate, severe? I mean, that's the nonlinearity invades that idea, and the nonlinearity is going to win every day. You know, if you're thinking it's linear, you're going to eventually potentially have a problem. And so those are the two things out of the whole icing thing. I mean, there's a whole bunch we could talk about, but those two ideas I think have been really interesting, and they really got me thinking more about how those ideas apply to all kinds of other things that we do.
Yeah, the nonlinearity piece is interesting. That sounds like a very arcane academic concept, but with very serious real world implications that we tend to as human beings just automatically connect dots and draw lines that are straight, but they're very rarely behave that way in the real world. So great, great perspective. Steve, at the end of every one of these episodes, we always like to close with a rapid fire question round we call Ready to Copy. So I'll throw out some questions on a variety of topics and you give me your quick answer. You ready to copy?
Absolutely.
Let's keep it going on icing for a second. Is ice bridging a myth?
It is. I can tell you that having analyzed almost 40 years of NTSB and FAA accident records, there is not a single one which ice bridging has caused. There are some that have ice bridging as a factor because the crew thought that was something to be concerned about, and they operated the pneumatic boots accordingly. Manufacturers still have procedures that reflect that, but there is nothing in the evidence that says that actually happens. I could probably tell you a little bit about there's a couple of things that are happening in there. One of them is we know it takes multiple cycles of a pneumatic boot to clear all the ice. It's not going to happen the first time you pop the boots. So if you have an auto feature, that's great. It's taken care of. If you're stuck with an airplane that has manual mode only, you're going to have to use multiple cycles of that boot to get rid of all the ice. So the first time you pop the boots and you look out and say, oh, it didn't get any. And it may look like all of the ice is still there and it may lead you to believe in ice bridging. That's not what's really happened.
What's the most valuable lesson you learned as a young freight pilot? You cut your teeth flying some maybe questionable airplanes, definitely in some questionable weather, kind of a classic formative experience for many pilots of your generation. What did you learn there that you took to the rest of your career?
The most important lesson I got out of that was the one I described in the second chapter of the book, which is just how to say no. We were operating in an environment where regulations were loose, if we shall we say, and it was really dependent on the crew to basically know how and when to say no. And my chief pilot, a fellow named John Brown, showed me that one night, and it really has stuck with me. It's a tough call. It's very hard. It was easy for him because he was senior. The owner of the company that was leaning on him needed him as the chief pilot. He wasn't in a position to fire him. But I learned the lesson, and I think the thing that's important about that is that as easy as it is to do, we have to consider how difficult it can be for young pilots in early employment situations, lots of pressure on them to produce. Making that decision to not go can be really, really hard, but it is an essential decision. You have to learn how to say no and when to say no.
Is airline flying more art or science?
Oh, there's a mix.
So I can still be a craftsman as an airline pilot, not just a button pusher.
Right. And to me, the craftsmanship is in how well you protect the margins and how well you construct your strategies. The science is extremely supportive. It's essential. If we look at icing, for example, you really do have to understand a lot about icing and about the science that's behind it. But there is still an art involved, and this is one of the biggest concerns we have with fully automated airplanes, single pilot ideas into the transport world, or the no pilot ideas, because we know a lot about what didn't work, what happened, what went wrong. We have all those accident reports. We have very little knowledge about what is done right every day. And because nothing happened, and decisions are made, they're not recorded. We don't know how close we came. So there's a fair amount of craftsmanship involved in there that we just cannot model. We don't know how to model that, and that threatens us when we start talking about how well we're going to program something to do everything, because we really don't know what everybody's been doing all this time.
You wrote an interesting article recently titled, "Did We Get Colgan Right?" referring to the Colgan crash in Buffalo that set in motion some of the ATP rules and many other things. It's an interesting article. We'll link to it in the show notes here. But what's your answer to that? Did we get it right? What has the industry done right and wrong after that accident?
I think we got a lot right. I mean, I think that there's no way to fault the improvements that came out of that. FAR Part 117, I have some issues. I would have done a few things differently, but you can't make any claim that it hasn't improved our safety. It certainly has. Stall training has been much improved. Lots of those things have happened. But I think we kind of missed the broad picture that was, to me, very clear in the final 3 minutes of the cockpit dialogue, which, of course, the board was very critical of, and rightfully so. I mean, it's not a time you need to be chatting in that manner. But the point is, what the crew was basically telling us was that they didn't know very much about icing. They didn't know a lot about what they were doing. And my interpretation is that they were basically trying to reassure themselves that they were okay. I don't know that we've done anything following the accident that has improved the overall aeronautical knowledge problem. And that's what was missing there. So we can do stall training, and we can do a bunch of these other things, and we can have safety management systems and all kinds of systems of accountability. But I'm not sure we've done anywhere near what has to be done to improve the overall aeronautical knowledge of your typical professional pilot, And I'm sure that applies as we come down into the small airplane pilots. I mean, I was working with some guys a few weeks ago, and there was a bit of a thunderstorm approaching, and people were concerned about it, but they didn't really see a problem because they could fly around it, and the rain wasn't too heavy. And I didn't hear anybody talk to me about the potential for a downburst, or what happens when that storm collapses, what happens to the wind shift. I made a comment to one guy, just be real careful of the wind. And my sense was that knowledge wasn't really there. You know, so those, I think it's endemic. And the Colgan crew was telling us that. And I'm not sure we listened. That's the thing I find most disturbing about that accident. It's one of the hardest voice recorder transcripts I've ever read in my life. It still is hard for me to read.
You learned the hard way about survival kits. What should pilots carry? Lots of pilots have sort of homemade habits, but if I'm going on a long cross country in my 172 or Bonanza, what should I actually have with me?
Well, that's a really good question, and obviously near and dear to my heart. I still carry one. I don't go anywhere in the airplane without it because I learned the hard way. From my experience, you have to consider that there's two possibilities. You're either going to be able to walk or you're not. If you can walk and you're east of the Mississippi, you're probably in good shape because you're probably going to be able to walk out. If you're west of the Mississippi, even if you can walk, you can have some problems. But if you can't walk, it doesn't matter where you are. I mean, you could be outside of Manhattan and you're still in serious trouble. So the first thing that's essential is you got to have water. When they finally got to me after 43 hours, I had created in my mind a long list of how many slushes I wanted, how many Cokes, how many glasses of milk. I was seriously dehydrated. You got to have water. Second thing is you got to have a way to stay warm. And I carry a wool blanket simply because wool will keep you warm if it gets damp. You got to have some way to stay warm. You don't go anywhere. I mean, it only up here in Vermont, I only stopped carrying parka 2 weeks ago because I just don't know what's going to happen at night. Third thing is signaling. They're going to be looking for you. But in my case, the ELT functioned, and very much thanks to the late Scandinavian Airlines captain Hans Gardsell, I'm here because he detected the ELT on the way across, on the way to Europe in a DC-8. Boston Center said they're looking for a guy down there, and Captain Gardsell made a racetrack pattern to come back and capture the INS coordinates more accurately. And if you've flown across the ocean, you realize that, you know, fuel is critical. You generally don't want to deviate like that, but he did it. Got the coordinates. Next day, the Air Force came over with a UH-1 Huey, and they spent the entire day drifting over the trees and could not find me.
Wow.
They knew I was in there. They could not find me. And what I didn't have was a signaling means. So what I needed was a Vary pistol with flares, smoke signals, something like that that I could have triggered that would have told them exactly where I was, and that would have saved 8 hours at least. You need the ELT. Your airplane's got one. A lot of us, myself included, carry a personal locator beacon because I want to be able to trigger it manually. Not that I don't trust the ELT, but I don't. One of the interesting things about an ELT after you crash is that you can't hear it because the radio's gone. Hmm. You don't know if it's worked or not, and I actually thought mine hadn't.
Hmm.
I thought, oh, that thing didn't, what, how, that ELT, it didn't work, I can't believe it. Well, it had, but you can't hear it. So you really want redundancy in your signaling systems. You've got to be able to signal, not just distant signals, but close-in signals, because like I said, you could be, in my case, I mean, again, I was very, very fortunate because the Huey crew, they had actually been instructed to go back to Plattsburgh and give up. And the aircraft commander said, not yet, and came back for one more look. And that's when they found me. And basically, they found me because crew chief was sitting in the doorway and the downwash blew the trees apart and they spotted the wreck.
Wow.
But that was the only way they found me. And it was just because he was determined that it worked out. So signaling devices.
Yeah.
After that, it's everything is icing on the cake. There's lots of things you can carry with you. A finger saw probably isn't necessary.
I would back up the POB comment. Those things are affordable enough now that it absolutely makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned Wind, Sand, and Stars earlier. One of my favorite books ever. Absolutely should be essential reading for any pilot. It holds up as well today as it did, 75 years ago. What's your favorite aviation book?
Probably that. Honestly, Wind, Sand, and Stars. I am sort of partial to North Star over my shoulder. One, because I flew for TWA. And two, because I had the chance to know Bob Buck and do some work with him. His son is a very close friend of mine. And so that, reading that book, I mean, for me, I can hear him. Mm. And he did something in the intro, which I thought was amazing, which was a very wonderful description of driving to work to fly TWA Flight 800 to Paris. And everything he says is consistent with all of my memories about going to work, Hangar 12, the check-in, all of the things that you did. And at no point did he mention what we think of when we think of TWA 800. Mm. And I just thought that was really classy. He handled that extremely well, and great book.
That is a great book. All right, Steve, our last question is always the same on pilot's discretion. You have one final flight, and we want to know, what are you flying and where are you going?
Oh, boy. Well, that's a really tough question. I mean, all of us, I think, would like to go back to something we did. I would love to fly a Convair again, just because I'd love to see if I could remember what it was I was doing. I did it for several years and successfully, but that's been a long time. But I think, I have a Piper Pacer, and I think that's the airplane that I just, I'm perfectly happy with flying that just about anywhere right now and just relaxing, putting my feet on the floor. And, you know, it's very, very relaxing to me because there's just not a lot to it. It's pretty easy. I'm hoping I can fly it across the country at some point. And that's, as I get older, that we're not going to do that too many more times.
Steve, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, John. It's good to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion, brought to you by Sporties, training and equipping pilots worldwide for over 60 years. For more episodes and today's show links, visit sporties.com/podcast. I'm John Zimmerman. We'll see you next time on Pilot's Discretion.